Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome, everyone. I'm Tracy McClure. Thanks for joining me. Coming up today, while financial crisis and economic woes are on everybody's minds, we hear why abortion should remain a key issue on the minds of U.S. Catholic voters in presidential elections this November. And the Lazarus effect, how one country is helping to bring a continent dying of AIDS back to life and hope. Europeans woke up Tuesday to stunning losses on international markets. In what's been labeled the U.S. financial world's 9/11, global markets plunged steeply following Congress's decision late Monday not to bail out a Wall Street staggering from mountainous debt, bad credit, and unfettered market speculation. The deepening economic crisis will undoubtedly be one of the very top concerns of Americans as voters prepare to cast their ballots in November's presidential election. The financial crisis, together with mounting home and job insecurity, has shoved other issues to the sidelines, at least for the moment. But one of the traditional sparring points between Democrat and Republican candidates simply won't go away. That is abortion. The Assistant Policy Director for the U.S. Bishops Pro-Life Commission, Deirdre McCade, says a culture in which abortion is unthinkable is one in which all lives will be honored. She spoke to Emer McCarthy about the U.S.'s uniquely liberal abortion laws that end up claiming the life of one child out of every four pregnancies.
Clearly, abortion has become far too available, far too readily accessible, far too easy a so-called solution to what many people see as a crisis in their lives, namely an unplanned pregnancy. But the bishops are saying this is at the heart of who we are. We defend human life. We stand with women and men and families who may be in crisis, who may find a pregnancy something difficult to accept, but abortion is not an answer. When the Supreme Court decided Roe versus Wade, this infamous decision back in 1973, that decision overturned all laws that protected unborn human life in the United States overnight. And the upshot of Roe versus Wade, along with its companion decision, Doe versus Bolton, was to make abortion legal in every state of the United States, legal throughout the 9 months of pregnancy for virtually any reason. And that's why we now have nearly one in four pregnancies ending in abortion. And most recent statistics available are that 1.2 million abortions are taking place per year. That number has come down since the late 80s. It's been steadily decreasing, but not nearly fast enough. Even though abortion has been legal in the United States for 35 years, polls continue to show that many people do not have basic information about abortion, such as when during pregnancy it's legal or why it's generally performed. Many people tend to think that abortion is relatively rare. It's not extreme in the United States, that we have a moderate set of abortion laws here in the United States, but actually we have some of the most radical abortion laws in the entire world, certainly in the developed world. People don't know because they have a misimpression based on, at least partly based on, the New York Times headline the day after Roe versus Wade was decided in 1973. The Times said, "High Court rules abortions legal in the first 3 months." That was an extremely misleading headline because basically Roe versus Wade said that the state couldn't in any way regulate abortion in the first 3 months, but that it had some grounds for regulating it in the second trimester and third trimester. But then Doe versus Bolton, the case that went along with it, defined the health exception that was used in second and third trimester abortion as all factors, this is a direct quote, physical, emotional, psychological, familial, and the woman's age relevant to the well-being of the patient. So that's tantamount to saying that if a woman's upset by her pregnancy, her unplanned pregnancy or unexpected pregnancy, that she can legitimately have an abortion for this so-called health reason. So when people talk about the health exception, they're not talking about a pregnancy that threatens the life of the mother. It's this incredibly broad exception. It's really the exception that swallows the rule. There is no meaningful grounds for in any way restricting abortions throughout the 9 months of pregnancy as a result of Roe versus Wade and Doe versus Bolton.
Pro-life issues, and in particular abortion, always come to the fore during campaign time, very often to be swept aside once the voting is over and the candidate is elected. What are you hoping to see done at a national level to try and make abortion unthinkable in the United States?
Well, the Bishop's Pastoral Plan for Pro-Life Activities calls for really a renewal of the culture through four different ways, and they apply to all different levels, national all the way down to the grassroots and the people in the pews. So it's comprehensive, really, and it includes federal legislative efforts. Those four pillars of the pastoral plan are public information and education, so myself being available to the media, ad campaigns that we have, pastoral care for women with problems related to pregnancy, as I mentioned, those who have been involved in abortion, caring for them, as well as advocacy for the disabled, or care for the disabled, sick, dying, and their families, as well as those on death row. Public policy is the third, and I'll get back to that in a moment more specifically, but we need to keep working at local, state, regional, and federal levels on public policy that works for the greatest possible protection of human life and measures that help make abortion, euthanasia, embryonic stem cell research unthinkable. Why would we ever exploit or destroy human life for the benefit of others? Human life is not the kind of thing that you could buy or sell or use or manipulate for somebody else's benefit. We have inviolable dignity. And so our public policy aspect is absolutely key in that effort. Then, of course, last but certainly not least is prayer. Prayer and worship. Prayer, rosaries, novenas, intercessory prayers at our masses, all of these efforts are absolutely central. If we were to do public information, pastoral care, and public policy without grounding it in prayer, our efforts would be practically for naught. We would get very little good done. We must be grounded in the reality that God is in control. Specifically at the federal level, negative initiative that we would fight would be the so-called Freedom of Choice Act, FOCA, which is a very, very threatening act. We've been able to keep it at bay so far, but if we have a Congress and a president in place who are in support of the so-called Freedom of Choice Act, all our hard work implementing incremental laws over the past 35 years under the burdensome precedent of Roe versus Wade will be undermined, completely gutted. Abortion on demand with no regulation will become the law of the land in our federal law, and that's the last thing. I can't even imagine what would happen if that went into effect. We must fight FOCA, and we have an ad that sets out how extreme FOCA's measures are on our website under our media section. People can learn about it there. The Freedom of Choice Act eliminates regulations that protect women from unsafe abortion clinics. It forces taxpayers to fund abortions across the entire country. It requires all states to allow partial birth and other late-term abortions. It subjects women to abortions by non-physicians and physicians who are non-licensed, who may have lost their license along the way. It violates the conscience rights of nurses, doctors, and hospitals, forcing them to at least refer, if not be involved in abortion. And it strips parents of their right to be involved in their minor daughter's abortion decision-making, among other very damaging provisions. That's what FOCA does.
Regardless if these, for example, nurses, doctors are Catholic, regardless if this is a child, a girl as young as 14, her parents won't be able to come in and have any involvement in her choice. How realistic is it that this measure could actually be passed in the future?
It is a very real threat, and everything depends on the composition of our Congress and which president might be in the Oval Office and willing to sign such a radical and destructive bill into law. There are current members of Congress, some of whom are involved in the presidential process, who are very deeply committed to passing FOCA. But Catholics are not alone in their opposition to abortion on demand. The vast majority of Americans, first of all, most Americans don't know how extreme our abortion law is, but when people are polled in a more specific kind of a way. For example, last summer, the New York Times, MTV, Music Television, and CBS News co-sponsored a poll of young people and found that 62% of young adults, these aren't just Catholics, 62% of young adults reject abortion on demand. And more recently, a poll of likely voters this June found that 54% of Americans would prohibit abortion in all circumstances or only allow it in the rare cases of rape, incest, and to save the life of the mother. That is hardly abortion on demand. The American public, if they knew what Roe versus Wade stood for and what the status of our abortion law was, would broadly rise up in opposition to it. But the fact is, it's been done very quietly, and FOCA would basically go beyond Roe versus Wade and make abortion on demand the law of the land, the law of our country. It is so extreme, I can't even tell you.
The conundrum that seems to be misleading a lot of people who claim to be Catholic is the following. When they see public figures who claim to be Catholic and then say that they are pro-choice, is it possible to be Catholic and be pro-choice?
It is a clear contradiction in terms. If one is Catholic, a confirmed Catholic, we've made a commitment to believe all the Church teaches and professes in faith and morals. And so I would say somebody who sees himself as pro-abortion or pro-choice is confused and misled, but not fully ascribing to what he or she is called to as a Catholic Christian believer. So those of us around people with those misled opinions need to respect them and love them enough to help them understand the Church's teaching more fully, because especially public figures who are espousing this as Catholics, they're causing scandal. They're making it sound as if one can be authentically Catholic and also in support of so-called reproductive rights, but that is never the case. That is, they are breaking down the communion of the faithful, not only their own communion potentially, but also all those around them. And that's cause for scandal.
As voters head to the polls in November to elect the next president, what must and what do voters need to keep in mind to be faithful citizens and vote in good conscience in November?
As voters, we must be conscientious in making sure that we're not promoting a government by our vote that is committed to intrinsic evils. That is one principle that we have to bear in mind. That, for example, a candidate's position on a single issue that involves an intrinsic evil, such as, this is directly quoting from Faithful Citizenship, a candidate's position on a single issue that involves an intrinsic evil, such as support for legal abortion or the promotion of racism, may legitimately lead a voter to disqualify a candidate from receiving support. Sometimes we're accused of being, quote-unquote, single-issue voters as if we don't take other things into consideration. That's not true, but there are certain lines that we cannot cross, and if a candidate for office is wholeheartedly committed to the promotion of or support of an intrinsic evil, such as legal abortion, then that can legitimately disqualify that candidate from our support. So the challenge is we have candidates, none of whom fully embrace Catholic thought, but if the fundamental right to life is in principle undermined, work for all these other goods that you mentioned, peace in the world, I mean, Lord knows we need to work for peaceful solutions to the war in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other places in the world, the question of immigration, the question of health care, all of that work only makes sense if we're honoring life from its earliest stages in its most intimate and vulnerable state. If we're not committed to the right to life from conception to natural death, all this other good work will be effectively for naught, because it's not coming from the right place, from the right understanding of the human person. And if peace doesn't begin in the womb, where can it begin?
Deirdre McCade is the Assistant Policy Director for the U.S. Bishops Pro-Life Commission. Over the past week, countries have pledged close to $16 billion to help poor countries fight poverty, disease, and assist agricultural development. A one-day high-level meeting at the UN in New York, September 25th, brought together world leaders, private sector representatives, and civil society partners to discuss specific ways to energize collaboration around the UN Millennium Development Goals. One of those goals is to halt the spread of HIV/AIDS by the year 2015. Well, it's one thing to pledge money, quite another to actually make good on the promise. One country that has made good on its unique promise to help Africa's poor is the United States. Over the past 5 years, the U.S. has almost single-handedly implemented the most ambitious project to combat AIDS, pouring into the African continent $15 billion into education and health treatment programs. I spoke recently to U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator Ambassador Mark Dybul for a rundown on the progress they've achieved and asked him if they'll meet the challenge to end the spread of AIDS by 2015.
The data from Africa, and Africa is important because two-thirds of the disease in the world is in Africa, which is rather extraordinary, has actually stabilized, and we've begun to see a decline across the continent. Some countries, substantial declines, 30%, 23% reductions in HIV rates. But it's still way too high. I mean, we don't want to just halt and reverse, because that halting would keep us at 30% of adult populations infected in some countries. We want to bring the rates down to remarkably lower levels. And there's great progress there. One of the things that's not in the Millennium Development Goals, because it's so new, is treatment. There is no Millennium Development Goal. And while we certainly want to prevent new infections, part of compassionate care, part of a human response, is to care for and treat those who are infected, because otherwise they'll die. And more than 20 million people have already died from this disease. Another 30 million will die if we don't intervene. And that's why the American people have responded in such a vigorous right way, not only to prevent new infections, but also to provide compassionate care and treatment for those already infected, and to care for the orphans that have been left behind as a result of the number of people who have died.
In Africa, what are the figures exactly of people infected and people who have actually contracted AIDS?
There are 33 million people about infected in the entire world, and two-thirds of them are in sub-Saharan Africa. So 20-some million people, 24, 25, 26 million people with HIV in sub-Saharan Africa, two-thirds of the epidemic.
Now, I was reading a little bit of a UN AIDS report for 2007, and the number of people affected by HIV in sub-Saharan Africa peaked in the year 2000 and has slowly, but like you said, steadily diminished since then. Deaths from AIDS, on the other hand, peaked in 2005 and have only just begun to diminish. How do you explain this discrepancy of 5 years for between 2000 and 2005?
Well, most people with HIV actually do not become sick for 10 years. Only half of people start to become sick and die at a 10-year period. So there's a lag between when you become infected and the infection rate and the death rate, and that's expected. But we have started to see a decline in the death rate, and that's a very exciting thing, and a lot of that probably has to do with the expansion of treatment. When President Bush announced his emergency plan for AIDS relief, it was the first time anyone had really addressed this on a global scale. There were only 50,000 people in all of sub-Saharan Africa receiving treatment. Through March of this year, the American people supported treatment for 1.7 million people. And so we're starting to see those changes. The other piece of the death rate, and I think this is very important and not captured in that number, is the orphan crises.
Absolutely.
12 million orphans from HIV/AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. And we know that orphans have a threefold higher risk of death if they don't have a parent. Because there's no one there to care for them. And just think about the next generation. With no parents, who's going to be there to care for the children? And HIV preferentially kills teachers. Two-thirds of teachers in Zambia were dying from HIV/AIDS. How do you educate the next generation? And so, you know, you talked about the Millennium Development Goals. Most of the Millennium Development Goals can't be reached in Africa, not just that HIV one, if we don't tackle HIV/AIDS. We can't do education. We can't tackle maternal and child health. We can't tackle overall death rates. One of the most exciting things we've seen, actually, is for the first time in a decade, because of HIV interventions in some of these countries, we're seeing increases in life expectancy and decreases in child mortality. Whereas before that, because of AIDS, we were seeing significant increases in child mortality and decreases in life expectancy. Life expectancy in Botswana went from 60 years to around 40 years because of HIV/AIDS. Extraordinary impact on societies. And AIDS is different than most diseases. It doesn't kill the very young and very old. It kills 15 to 50-year-olds, the most reproductive and productive part of society. So if you knock out that generation of individuals, it was looking pretty bleak for Africa. Now everything's changed. And what's changed most is there's hope. Hope has been recreated in Africa, and that's changing the whole dynamic.
How is this program implemented exactly? I know that you cooperate also with the Catholic Church mm-hmm. in many instances. There are programs like the lay community Sant'Egidio, which has a very important structure mm-hmm. in Mozambique mm-hmm. where they're treating HIV and AIDS patients. How exactly are you implementing mm-hmm. this project?
We do, in fact, work with many Catholic and Christian and faith-based organizations, and that was intentional. I think one of the revolutionary aspects of this program, and actually how President Bush has approached development, I think is something fundamentally that people of faith understand, because it begins with the dignity and worth of every human life, and it begins with the belief in each person and their ability to rise above, own their lives, and do extraordinary things with a little support. And so we have fundamentally reached into the community to find those heroes, otherwise ordinary people who will do heroic work with a little support, and they're the ones who are doing the work. So what we do is filter money down 80% of our partners are local organizations, 80% of our partners, about 24% of them are faith-based organizations. Catholic Relief Services is one of our largest implementing partners. Sant'Egidio is engaged in a number of countries, but it's not just the ones you hear about. It's the very many small local organizations, and you've got to engage them. You know, 30 to 70% of healthcare in sub-Saharan Africa is provided by faith-based organizations. 30 to 70%, and how are you going to tackle this epidemic? And more than that, in every community, we have to change human behavior. We have to get people to respect themselves and respect others and act on that in socially and sexually responsible ways. And people listen to their leaders, including their faith leaders and their community leaders. And so we've got to get to them and get them engaged. And that's fundamentally what we've been doing, getting, as President Bush says, meeting people where they are. And that involves the community, and that often involves the faith community.
With the problems that the United States faces domestically, internationally, the war in Iraq, Afghanistan, and so on, why so much priority importance on AIDS in Africa?
Well, it begins with that fundamental belief which President Bush has expressed, but really reflects who the American people are. And that's why we have such strong bipartisan support. This isn't just a Republican issue. It's not a Democratic issue. It's an issue for the American people. President Bush has always said, when he talks about this initiative and his other initiatives, you know, we've tripled development overall. This is a piece of a much bigger attempt to lift people up and support them. He always says, to whom much is given, much is required. That's where this comes from, and that should be something that resonates with many of the people who would be listening. He always says, to whom much is given, much is required. So whatever problems the United States has, whatever financial difficulties we have, we are a very wealthy people. We are very compassionate people, and so we have the capacity to do more. And on our Senate floor, as the renewal of our law was being discussed, several people raised this issue. You know, we have other problems, and the senators were very strong, and they said, look, we should never have to have a discussion of this versus that. We have the ability to do both. So that, I think, is there. The other reason is more and deeper. As we mentioned, HIV/AIDS knocks out a generation of parents, teachers, peacekeepers, healthcare workers, actually preferentially infects those people, workers, people are earning a living. So we're knocking out that generation, leaving a generation of orphans. That's creating a hopelessness. It's difficult to describe how hopeless most communities felt because of HIV/AIDS. Their weekends, streets were clogged with coffins going out to be buried. There was a pall over communities, a total sense of helplessness.
It sounds like you were there personally.
Yes, I have been many times. A sense of real hopelessness and helplessness. And as President Bush has said, that's a perfect breeding ground for fanaticism and instability. And the UN's General Assembly actually had only special session on HIV and talked about the security risks of HIV/AIDS. So while this is fundamentally a humanitarian, to whom much is given, much is required initiative, there is a component of this is very important for peace and security as well.
What are the most important, well, the most effective means of combating the spread of HIV and AIDS?
Well, in terms of spread, which is the prevention, the most important thing is human and sexual responsibility. But it's also more complicated than that because we see transgenerational sex, older men preying on younger girls. We see transactional activity, people trying to get food and education for their children. So it's a very complicated issue. But the data tell us that delaying when you become sexually active, having social responsibility, it has a significant impact on the epidemic. Reducing your partners, ideally having one partner to whom you are faithful throughout your life, both being HIV negative. And those are the things we know, the data are overwhelming, are effective, and we know that's the case. And we put a lot of emphasis on the need for that whole package. But you have to go deeper than that. You're really talking about getting to five-year-old children to teach them a different way of looking at themselves and looking at the world. Getting back to their own dignity and worth, teaching them to respect themselves, to respect others. That's the fundamental message. And if that is part of who they are, and if they understand that they are cared about and loved and important to society, that will change how they behave in society and change their relationships to others. We're already seeing changes in the way young boys treat young girls. We're seeing differences in how they perceive themselves, and that leads to a more socially responsible behavior. So it really is fundamentally changing how young people view themselves and how society views them as loved individuals who we believe are our future and are treated that way. And that's what's changing things. And that's where the hope is really coming from, the sense that we believe in you. It goes back to that fundamental principle, dignity and worth of every human life and belief in every person and every person's unique capabilities and supporting them. And if you do that, we'll actually tackle the epidemic.
So that you're saying starting even before adolescence, when kids are as young as five and you know, they're not even there yet.
Exactly right. Change mm-hmm. their social norms. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to change a 25-year-old's behavior. Mm-hmm. You've got to start when you're young. We learn this in smoking campaigns. We learn this in many other aspects of public health. And this is difficult. This is human, fundamental to human behavior. So you've got to start young. But it's that fundamental message of you have dignity and worth. We believe in you. That is fundamental in Africa to tell people we believe in you. And from presidents down to people in the community, they tell us that that's made as much a difference as the drugs. The fact that the people of the United States believe in them and care about them means a great deal to them.
But if the parents are dying, the grandparents are dying, and the teachers are dying, who is getting this message across?
That's where it comes to the full community. And this is one of the beautiful things of, for example, in Africa. Africa, they actually don't – the sense of an orphan is very unusual to them. They don't really have words for it because children aren't owned by a family. They're owned by the community. You are a child of a community. So the natural approach is for other family members or the community, if the family members are not available, to take care of a child. But that requires resources. Often it's the grandparents. You know, many of the grandparents are alive because it was the young – this disease has fundamentally been over the last 20 years. So it's the grannies who are often taking care of the kids, and we're working to support them. But it really is to build a social structure where there is that love and support in a community. Orphanage is something we actually don't have to do very much and try to avoid because we know kids will do better in their community. So that's the problem, though. We lost this generation, so we have to build it back up using all of the tools of the community, which means the faith sector, which means the private sector and community-based organizations.
2015 is right around the corner. Are we going to make that deadline?
Well, deadlines are, you know, things that we put into place for good reason to try to drive things. We had a 5-year goal. President Bush set up a 5-year goal. His emergency plan for AIDS relief, often called PEPFAR, President's Emergency Plan for AIDS, is the largest international health initiative in history ever for a single disease. We had 5-year goals to support treatment for 2 million people, to support the prevention of 7 million new infections, which is 60% of infections in the countries we were working in, and to care for 10 million, including orphans and vulnerable children. We're going to meet those goals, and we're going to meet them within the year because that's when the 5 years is up. Our Congress has just set another 5-year goal for us with the president's leadership, 3 million in treatment, 12 million infections averted, 12 million in care, including orphans and vulnerable children, and we're going to meet those too. So we are on track. The American people are on track to meet its commitments. I think one of the great tragedies here is currently the American people are providing 55% of all global resources for HIV/AIDS. 55%. As long as one country is doing that, we'll meet the goals we've set, which are substantial goals. But until the rest of the world responds to this epidemic, we cannot meet the goals because we don't have the resources. Global community has made commitments in the G8 and in other places, but we haven't met them. The United States has met them. A few other countries have. Others have not. So if we just meet our current commitments, we'd do pretty well. This is the most exciting thing. We talked about hopelessness. If you go to places, as I'm privileged to do, from 6-month intervals, you see a hope coming that is unstoppable. Because we are supporting people at the community, there is a fundamental, palpable change in individuals, communities, entire countries. People who thought their lives were taken away from them have been given back to them. They call it the Lazarus effect, actually. That what they thought was absolute death and despair for their society and for people is now being given back to them. And that hope, when you create it, is unstoppable. It is more powerful than any money and more powerful than any program. And that is what will be the engine of change.
Ambassador Mark Dybul is the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.